Well, welcome to the Michiana Adventist Forum. Glad to have you all here. I think you'll find it a rewarding afternoon. There's a couple housekeeping things. There's a light bulb broke and shattered glass over there. We tried to clean up, but don't walk around your bare feet in that bare area over there. And I guess we're still suffering the effects of a lightning strike. I would joke that it was the last forum meeting, but it really wasn't at the forum meeting. But we still don't have complete control of the lights over there, so, but that shouldn't be a problem. Well, our topic today is presented by Dr. Terry Dopp Amod from Walla Walla University, talking about the recent book, Ellen White Goes Public, the collaborative biography project, Ellen Harmon White, American Prophet. And after the presentation, we will have a time for discussion and questions, and Gary Gray will have a mobile mic to facilitate that. And if you could ask your questions into the mic so that we can get them on the recording, hopefully. Well, as we begin our time together, Jane Thayer is going to offer a word of prayer.
Thank you. Father in heaven, we thank you today for many blessings, and especially now for the Sabbath, which gives us time away from our work to do other things that are important and to be together. We are thinking today and remembering with joy and sadness our colleague, Gary Land, who was so important to this project that is going to be discussed today. And we ask for your presence as we consider the life and work of Ellen White, who was so important to this denomination. So we ask for your presence this day. We ask in the name of Jesus. Amen.
Amen. As we reflect today on the topic and the role of one of the pioneers of our faith community, I would offer you a brief meditation on our spiritual forebears' influence on who we are today. It was penned by Barbara Peskin, who is a retired minister living in Wisconsin. Because of those who came before, we are. In spite of their failings, we believe. Because of and in spite of the horizons of their visions, we too dream. A couple comments about upcoming events. Our next forum program is on Sabbath afternoon, November 15. Dr. Richard Rice from the School of Religion at Loma Linda University will be speaking to us. His title is Suffering and the Search for Meaning, which is also a book title. His recent book that was published this year by InterVarsity Press. And then on January 23, Dr. Carl Bailey, the coordinator of the Behavioral Neuroscience Program here at Andrews, will be speaking to us about some research he's been involved in on how Adventist youth internalize Sabbath-keeping behaviors. And then later on in the season, Dr. Manuela Castiglielli, who was director of the European Value Genesis Study, on we're talking about research findings from that study of Adventist youth in Europe. And then, Deborah Baris, a local attorney who practices family law, will be speaking to us about alternative forms of dispute resolution and collaborative approaches to conflict resolution. I'd also call your attention to an event next weekend here on campus that some of you may be interested in. It's the 9th Annual Andrews Autumn Conference on Religion and Science. And the keynote speaker is Dr. Nancy Murphy from Fuller Theological Seminary. Any of you that have read any of her books or heard her present before know that it will be a treat. Carl Bailey and some other people from Andrews and Notre Dame will also be making presentations at the conference. Professor Murphy will be speaking 7 o'clock Friday evening in the seminary chapel, and then the rest of the events of the conference will be on Sabbath starting at 9 o'clock in the Science Complex and running all day. So you're all invited, and Gary Burdick is the point person if you need some additional information on that. Just remind you, there's some sheets in the back for signing up for email notifications if you're not getting them and would like to get announcements about our programs. And we do appreciate the behind-the-scenes work that Jim and Debbie and Terry do to get the word out about our programs and to make the recordings available on the web. Well, today's discussion, as mentioned, is by Terry Amod. It deals with the story behind the book, Ellen Harmon White, American Prophet, which was published this year by Oxford University Press. And just a little perspective, just in last week's issue, not this week, but last week's issue of Christian Century, they have a fall book issue, and scholars in different areas pick five of the most important recently published books in their area. And Ellen Harmon White, American Prophet, is right on number two in the list of the Oxford University publications. And a very nice write-up about the book and the role of Adventists in the world community today. There have been various other reviews that have been quite favorable. The book grew out of a conference back in, was it 2009? Yeah, that was organized by Terry and Gary Land and Ron Numbers, held up in Maine. And there were a group of invited scholars, some Adventists, some Adventist alumni, some non-Adventists, who presented papers on various topics related to Ellen White's in relation to the world she lived in, and there were responses to each paper and discussions, and then a arduous process of getting the manuscripts and editing them and putting them together into a book, which was just published in May by Oxford University Press. Just a couple words about our speaker's background. She grew up in Alaska, California, Massachusetts, Virginia. So you probably can guess that her father worked for the denomination as a pastor, and she got to live and go to school in various interesting places, graduated from Shenandoah Valley Academy and Columbia Union College, went on to earn a master's at William & Mary and a PhD from Boston University. She worked at Guide Magazine and as a publications officer for Loma Linda University Medical Center before she joined Walla Walla College, which is now Walla Walla University, where she is professor of history and of English. Her interest is in American religious history. Some of the things that have attracted her attention have been Harriet Beecher Stowe and the Shakers, and of local interest, the House of David religious community here in Benton Harbor, and its role in integrating baseball back some years ago. She's currently working on a biography of Ellen White, which is to be titled Ellen White, Voice and Vision. She lives, of course, in Walla Walla, Washington, with her husband Larry, who is a professor of electrical engineering at the university. They have two college-age children and enjoy all sorts of outdoor activities like skiing, backpacking, running, cycling, and so on. So we welcome you to the Adventist Forum, and the time is yours.
Thank you very much for the invitation to come here, and thank you to the Forum, Michiana Forum chapter, that keeps thoughtful discussion vibrant here in this community. Thank you so much for doing that. Ellen White devoted her 70-year public career to developing a community of believers. She and her husband James and their close associate Joseph Bates appealed to the Holy Spirit to help them forge a functional church from a small band of fractious, disappointed Millerites. Her visions helped the early community form a consensus around central teachings about the Sabbath, the sanctuary, and the second advent, and the close of probation, the final judgment. Her testimony letters sought to turn gossiping, backbiting congregations into communities of faith. Her articles and books exhorted Adventists toward more exalted levels of diet, dress, faith, temperance, and racial tolerance. She pushed every technological and media button available in the 19th century, inspiring her denomination to form a vast publishing network, the largest Protestant educational system in the world, a global mission network, an intricately designed and tight-knit church administration, a healthcare conglomerate, and a worldwide body that today numbers 18 million adult members. It's hard to imagine where Seventh-day Adventists would be without Ellen White. Perhaps without her and her spiritual gifts, the group would look more like the band who continued to follow William Miller, the Advent Christians, who now claim about 100,000 members worldwide and who parted ways with their higher education institution, Aurora College, in 1971. A body of faith forms from the conviction that it constitutes a partnership between the human and the divine, with each side of the equation being essential. When she felt the call to become part of that equation, Ellen Harmon felt weak, infirm, unequal to the task. Toward the end of her long life, though, she acknowledged that in certain ways her infirmities became the source of her spiritual strength and her spiritual focus. And when we study her today, we think a great deal about what she did within the circle of Adventism, where her influence is incalculable. We've spent less time thinking about how she related to the general public. But however, talking to the general public was an important part of her life work. Although nearly forgotten today, Ellen White's connection with public audiences provided a reality check as she navigated the turbulent early life of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. As a group of Adventist academics sought in 2007 to begin planning to reintroduce her to a segment of the public, historical scholars, we examined again the public dimension of her career during her lifetime. Ellen White felt that her church's focus should be directed outward as well as inward. She knew how to adapt her message to meet her audience's needs and their level of understanding. And her public validation of her insights lent authenticity and authority to her counsels to her fellow believers. Ellen Harmon's first message to a larger audience was a personal, spiritual one. It was 1842, nearly time for the world to end, and more people around Portland, Maine seemed to know it. Ellen Harmon believed it more fervently than most and wrestled with her unworthiness to meet Jesus face to face. She's 14, turning 15 at this time. Several times she had already felt assurance of salvation, but there was still room for doubt. Just 14, self-conscious about a facial injury, she was ready for a private relationship, just her and God. But she felt a tug to show her commitment in public, not just by attending services, but by participating with her voice. She was terrified. What if she began the sacred act of praying out loud and then lost her train of thought? Panic would lead to a self-fulfilling prophecy of stammering, or worse yet, silence, personal humiliation, embarrassment to God's cause. Every time she prayed alone in silence, something inside impressed her that it was a commitment on that level was not enough. So she stopped praying altogether, found herself, she said, in a melancholy state, finally in deep despair. After she suffered privately for months, How could she tell someone else? No one would understand her dilemma. When you're a teenager, you know these things. Her mother invited her to join a group worshiping at her uncle's house. I consented to go with my mother, she recalled later, to please her. As the group knelt to pray, one of her earlier pleas was answered. Her crippling anxiety disappeared. My mouth was opened. No sooner did I begin to speak than the power of God gave voice that reached a mile, and there I dedicated myself to God, she remembered. This meeting had not been her uncle's idea. He had lost his faith. I cannot live in this house. I must get out of it, he said in panic when he heard his niece's shouts of spiritual ecstasy. I know what that is. I have had it. I have passed through that experience of loving and serving God, but I am a backslider. Do get her out of the house. His niece did not go home that night. These things happened in Methodist circles. Occasionally, when people were overcome by the Spirit in an evening meeting, they did not have strength to go home until the next day. We cannot get her out of the house, her prayer partners told her uncle. She's helpless. Helpless, perhaps, but far from silent. From that day, the cloud burst, she said. When this victory came to me, I have held it with a grip that would never let it go. I went from house to house, and I did not go to greet the people. I went right to my companions and talked with them all night long, and I would pray with them until they gave their hearts to God, and thus I went from street to street and house to house and worked in my childhood, and I have worked ever since. The latter part of this description comes from a sermon Ellen White preached 67 years later in 1909. Her breakthrough about praying and witnessing in public was a crucial foundational moment for her 70-year public career, which began in earnest in late 1844, 2 years after this event. Now, although most of her encounters with the public were positive, the early years of her career presented challenges. Other people, including several other young women, were also having visionary experiences. Ann Taves has noted that M.F. Whittier, the brother of the poet John Greenleaf Whittier, wrote that among Portland's children of light, nothing was more common than visions. Frederick Hoyt documented at least 5 radical Adventist visionaries, in addition to Ellen Harmon, active at that time, including William Foy, Emily Clemens, Dorinda Baker, Phoebe Knapp, and Mary Hamblin. According to Ann Taves, new sources documenting the events of this period have proved disconcerting for many Seventh-day Adventists, but they do not so much undercut a careful reading of White's most detailed accounts of this period as heighten our understanding of the crisis of authority radical Adventists faced at this time. While doing newspaper research on Adventist history in Maine in the 1970s, Frederick Hoyt discovered accounts of the 1845 trial of a radical Adventist from Atkinson, Maine, Israel Damon. Ellen White discussed this incident in an 1860 edition of her book, Experience and Views, and she indicated that she was present at the meeting and was in fact speaking when Elder Damon was arrested for disturbing the peace. Not only was her depiction of Elder Damon sympathetic, but the story she told about his arrest was cast in the idiom of the shout tradition. Although she was not charged and did not testify at the trial, her name came up and her role was discussed several times. The newspaper report refers to 2 vision women, Sister Dorinda Baker of Orrington and Sister Ellen Harmon of Portland. According to the testimony at the trial, the witnesses all agreed that the 2 women spent much of the meeting lying on their backs in the floor in a trance. Many who were present testified that their visions were genuine. It was only later that Ellen White would emerge as a singular force, and when she faced the public in later years, the settings were conventional. Once Seventh-day Adventists had formed a denomination at Battle Creek, Michigan in 1863. Its membership continued to expand outside the group's Methodist and Christian connection roots in New England. The congregation became more diverse. And during the 1860s and early 1870s, while they were living in Michigan, James and Ellen White spent a good deal of time attending camp meetings and speaking to Adventist congregations. At the same time, Ellen White spoke more and more frequently to audiences who were not Adventists. These guest sermons followed traditional discourse modes, did not include visions. At these appointments, she was careful not to offend the congregations with sectarian messages, and she refrained from the pointed testimonies that she aimed at her own fellow church members. While traveling through Michigan with James in the spring of 1868, she was invited to speak in the Tuscola, Michigan Methodist Church. She spoke for about half an hour and a half on themes of salvation to a standing room only congregation. After her sermon, she was surprised to learn that she had used the same text employed by the Methodist minister in the same church that morning. She noted with satisfaction that one of the wealthier and most influential men in town stated that she had carried it much higher than our minister. James spoke briefly after her talk, and she reported that his remarks were also well received. Ellen White welcomed the opportunity that these speaking forays presented to dissipate prejudice against Adventists. Near the beginning of the 1875 camp meeting season, Ellen and James traveled to Gallatin, Missouri. A local newspaper described that they were delayed from their onward journey by rain. So they stopped for the evening, and they decided to preach at a Christian church that night. James delivered a sermon on Adventist doctrine, and then he announced that Ellen would speak there the next morning. It was a Sunday morning, but it would be at a time that would not interfere with other church services. According to a newspaper account, an elder Schick, pastor of the church, stated that as long as there was a positive command in the Bible against women teaching, she would not have the use of their church. And so instead of speaking at the church on Sunday morning, she spoke on Sunday afternoon at the courthouse. And of course, the newspaper was there to notice. The courtroom was crowded, reported the newspaper, nothing like a little controversy to draw an audience. She delivered a very interesting and instructive discourse concerning the duties of parents in the proper training of their children, both physically and morally. No one could object to the sentiment she proclaimed, and we doubt not many will be benefited from having heard her. She is a pleasant, forcible speaker, and the audience, after having listened attentively an hour, were not weary. Ellen White's choice of subject matter on this occasion was surely intended to reassure the community that her public expressions harmonize with traditional gender expectations. But that is not to say that she felt she could be easily compartmentalized into a particular ideological box. Now, a prominent feature of her 1878 and 1880 trips to the Pacific Northwest were multiple public speaking engagements. After a sermon at a large Methodist church in Salem, Oregon, during the camp meeting there, she reported to James that one of the Methodist ministers said to Brother Levitt that he regretted that Mrs. White was not a staunch Methodist, for they would make her a bishop at once. Her reputation continued to extend beyond her own denomination. As Ellen's speaking career intensified in the 1870s, James's health became increasingly precarious. They continued to travel together when he was feeling well enough, but Ellen increasingly would meet speaking engagements alone and report them to James in detailed letters. On June 29, 1874, Ellen was in Minnesota. The weather was so hot she could only speak in the evening. She recounted to James a particular triumph. Four young men stood around after her Sunday evening temperance lecture, sharing a jug of whiskey, the ingredient that had given so many 19th century American camp meetings a bad name. A brother reported their conversation to Ellen. "Let's have a good drink," one said, "to close up on." "No," said another, "I shall never drink another drop of liquor as long as I live." When his friend protested, he said, "No, I shall never allow another drop of liquor to pass my lips." He dashed the jug against a tree, saying, "That woman's sermon has converted me." Ellen appeared to enjoy telling this story, and it illustrated for James the effectiveness of her temperance sermons. The pinnacle of her public speaking career coincided with her partnership with her niece, Mary Clough, who proved to be an able publicist for her aunt's speaking tours, as well as a capable editor of her manuscripts. Ellen White owed her most memorable season of public speaking, the summers of 1875 and 1876, in part to her niece, Mary Clow. Now, Mary sympathized with her aunt's religion, but never entered the Adventist fold. Her ability to communicate with the general public, though, was unmatched during Ellen White's career. A skilled writer and editor and journalist, Mary Clow expended some serious shoe leather on advance work, carrying news releases to local papers days ahead of Ellen White's arrival. By the summer of 1875, Mary was doing advance work along the camp meeting circuit, sending news releases to nearby newspapers, arranging interviews with journalists on the camp meeting grounds, and she dove into her publicity work with enthusiasm. She hired up to 6 copyists to make transcripts of news releases and copies of Ellen White's remarks for eventual publication. She would have loved to have had a Xerox machine or one of those little tiny printers. Ellen noted that both she and Mary lost all of their appetite for the appalling camp meeting food, and imagine what it was like with no refrigeration. It was really horrible. But Mary never complained. Ellen and Mary and sometimes James swept through the Midwest and the East Coast during the summers of 1875, 1876, and 1877. And with Mary Clow's help, the accomplishments of Ellen White became to the attention of the general public. Curiosity seekers would come in increasingly larger numbers to Adventist campgrounds. And she offered more sermons and lectures on health and temperance as the needs arose. This activity peaked in 1876 during the camp meeting at Groveland, Massachusetts, swelling the audience of 500 campers. Crowds of non-Adventists flocked to the site on special trains that were dedicated to the event, undoubtedly encouraged by Mary Clow's glowing press releases. By Sunday, August 27, Clow later reported that trains from nearby towns filled with what she said intelligent, in other words, well-educated people, arrived for the morning meeting and heard James White preach. As the trains continued to roll in, Ellen White prepared to take her turn at the podium in the afternoon to deliver a temperance sermon. Mary Clow later noted that 20,000 were estimated to be on the grounds, and Ellen called it the most solemn sight I ever beheld. To top it off, the Temperance Reform Club that from nearby Haverhill, Massachusetts, invited her to address an audience of 1,000 at the City Hall on Monday evening. Ellen and James were escorted to a large platform that was about 15 to 20 feet above the heads of the crowd. And on the platform and in the crowd were what Ellen called the first men of Haverhill. She wrote to her son, Edson, and his wife, Emma. Although she had had a severe headache for several days and was nervous, she recalled, "The Lord helped me speak. I was never more clear. I was stopped several times with clapping of hands and stomping of feet. I never had a more signal victory." Now, many years later, S.N. Haskell, who was along on that tour, he had organized the event and helped coordinate the publicity along with Mary Clow, recalled that James had advised Ellen not to discuss tobacco at her evening temperance lecture, since some of the 25 or so community leaders who would be sitting with her on the platform were tobacco users, and they had stains on their beards to advertise the fact. Instead of not saying anything about tobacco, Haskell recalled, she gave one of the strongest discourses on the tobacco curse. But they said amen to what she said and declared that although they had not given it up, they thought perhaps they would. So much for moderation on the tobacco issue. Ellen White's development as a public speaker faltered when James died in Battle Creek on August 6, 1881, a few days after he contracted malarial fever. She returned to California after James' funeral on August 13 and attended the Sacramento camp meeting in October 1881. Newspaper accounts of that event noted that she was still recovering from her own recent illness. She also had had malarial fever, and from the death of her husband. In the Sacramento camp meeting, though, she was able to kindle some of her usual fervor against one of her favorite villains, tobacco, which she called the most enslaving of the vices. "The tree of life has no branches that bear tobacco," she warned their audience. But her speaking engagements for the next year were few and far between. And I think in some way she thought her public life was over after James died. But in late August 1882, she was felled by another bout of fever while she was in Oakland. Willie and his wife transported her to Healdsburg in September, fearing that she would die on the way. But in early October, she asked Willie to take her to the local camp meeting, and once again, public speaking rallied her. She would spend several more decades speaking in public. And after she returned from Australia in 1900, where she'd spent nearly 9 years, newspaper reporters were increasingly scrutinizing the messages she gave to her own Adventist audience, because now there were over 100,000 Adventists worldwide, and people were starting to pay attention. Building on the organizational role she played at the 1901 General Conference in Battle Creek, as well as the 1903 General Conference in Oakland, California, she again headlined the General Conference session in 1905, which for the first time was held in Tacoma Park, Maryland. This was a crucial gathering because the denomination, having just moved the headquarters following her advice, had rankled many Michigan Adventists in the process. In the nation's capital, though, the general public were paying attention to Adventist conversations. Newspapers in the area, the Washington Post, the Washington Star News, gave significant attention to the first Adventist gathering there. In 1905, it reported that there were 300 Adventist delegates from all over the world living in tents on the grounds of the newly constructed Washington Missionary College. The opening meeting convened in a large tent on May 11. A local newspaper said there were 50 missionaries sitting on the platform. This would help explain the rapid growth of the church around the world, as well as Mrs. E.G. White, a very aged lady who was one of the first writers and early pioneers of the Seventh-day Adventists, who was seated upon the stage in a large easy chair. After the opening remarks, she gave the keynote address. A recurring theme during the 1905 session was religious liberty, and that was a message not only for Adventists internally, but for the general public. For months, the local press had reported discussions raised by Adventists about Sunday legislation and religious instruction in public schools. Ellen White and other speakers emphasized why it was important for the denomination to make its religious liberty views heard in the nation's capital, thus validating the move from Battle Creek. And of course, she got a big write-up in the largely circulation paper as a result. Ellen White played a significant role in one more general conference session, the one held in Tacoma Park in 1909. She had focused on organizational and ecclesiastical matters in 1901 and 1903 and 1905, but in 1909, she was returning to her religious roots, a focus on the imminent end of the world. One of her motives for traveling east was to visit her old hometown again, because this was a large speaking tour. It took her down into the South, to Washington, D.C., up to Maine, through Lincoln, Nebraska, many other places. "I expect to visit some of the places where I labored in my early youth during the 1844 movement," she told a congregation in Tacoma Park. "I should like to visit Portland, Maine, once more, where in my childhood, as it were, the Lord gave me a message that bore everything before it." No doubt her own mortality was on her mind as she read news accounts of religious persecution and international strife. "I was instructed only a few weeks ago that Portland must be given this last message to the world," she told her Tacoma Park congregation, noting that she felt drawn to her own roots in Maine. "We cannot afford, in the few days that we have here on earth, to spend our time in trifling and nothingness," she urged another gathering as she sought to enlist them in helping her evangelize the large cities of the East. "When I think of the great work there is to be done, I feel that I must get right out as I did in my younger days. Then I labored when I was no stronger than I am now, and I saw the power of God revealed in a remarkable manner." As she looked back to the beginning of her own career in New England, she referred to it as her childhood, "when the Lord gave me a message that bore everything before it. In those days, it was not the testimony of a young girl that had a telling effect. It was the power of the Holy Spirit accompanying the message that touched hearts." The advance publicity for her trip to Portland would have pleased Mary Clough. On July 6th, the day Ellen White began to preach, the Portland Evening Express printed a long article they'd already put together, reviewing her biography and her history of her faith. A publicity item that interests the paper was the note that many of the ministers of other denominations than the Adventists would ask her to attend their meetings and exhort for them. While Mrs. White was in town, a reporter sat down with her for a long interview. This reporter was obviously charmed by her articulateness and her presence, and reported in a large article published above the fold on page one with a banner headline, "World Hurrying to Ruin. We are living in the time of the end," says Mrs. White. The enthusiastic reporter commented that Ellen White appeared 30 years younger than her actual age. Mrs. White expressed the desire to get a special message across to her former hometown. "We are living in the time of the end," she told the reporter, who recorded what amounted to a miniature sermon explaining why the calamities described in the news indicated that the world would end soon. And this is right before World War I erupted, which was seen in apocalyptic terms by many, many people around the world. Okay, then the Portland Evening Express, continuing to cover her visit, interviewed Adventist leaders who were traveling with her. The paper noted that Seventh-day Adventists looked to her as the one who, by the power of her preaching and the force of her personality, united the denomination and fostered its growth to its present importance. The Daily Eastern Argus, which was another paper in Portland, caught her motive for coming to Portland. She spoke very feelingly for the city of Portland, that its people might be prepared to meet Christ. And this is so similar to her message to Portland in 1842 that was echoing around the streets around her uncle's house when she was a teenager. And on her way home to California, speaking in Massachusetts, New York, Michigan, Iowa, Kansas, and Colorado, because she was in Nebraska on the way out, she asked the believers that she met to contribute funds for a church building for the small congregation in Portland. The city where she began her speaking career was on her mind as she neared the end of her life. From her ecstatic shouts in 1842 to her final speaking tour in 1909 at age 81, Ellen White's career concluded a significant public dimension. As Ellen White endured her final injury and illness in 1915, her assistants contacted newspapers all over the country, this time to prepare them for an imminent announcement of her death. When the end came on July 16, Clarence Crisler's obituary mentioned that in her role as an evangelist, she often preached to thousands, her voice having resonance and carrying power, and he emphasized her public speaking on temperance and health. In August 1915, the Independent magazine noted that the United States had recently lost two prophetesses, Mary Baker Eddy in 1910 and Ellen G. Harmon White in that year. "Many of Mrs. Eddy's disciples believed she would never die," noted the author, "and Mrs. White hoped to be one of those who would be taken up alive to meet the Lord in the air. But the Lord delayed his coming, and she entered into her rest, just as others do, in her 88th year." The article compared both women to the first American prophetess, Anne Hutchinson. Although Ellen White declined to claim the title of prophet, she would have agreed that she filled the prophetic function of exhorting the faithful, calling the unfaithful to repentance, and appealing to the undecided. Now, a significant slice of the public remembered Ellen White in 1915 and were reminded of her ministry by these obituaries that appeared around the country. Let's fast forward to 2009. The Seventh-day Adventist Church had grown impressively during the interval of nearly a century, and Ellen White's books and organizational strategies could be seen all over the world. Her spiritual classic, Steps to Christ, had become available in more than 165 languages, and that number keeps increasing. She has been well known among Adventists worldwide. Outside the denomination, however, she has all but disappeared. Adventists had little, if any, presence in religious history books, and Ellen White was known primarily for her health teachings or in some historical encyclopedias, post-Millerite ideas about the shut door. And there's some fascination about the shut door among encyclopedia writers that I haven't yet quite come to understand. It's interesting to see how American history college textbooks handle the story of innovative religious groups in the 19th century. American historians love the Mormon story. Its innovations, its westward migration connect with a larger American historical narrative, and sex and violence abound. Survey textbook writers lavish attention on the Mormons. They feel obligated to mention the Millerites, but until recently, those notations have been brief and inaccurate, picking up on myths that were disproved in the 1950s by the few historians who were paying attention then. The appearance of The Disappointed in 1987, edited by Ronald Numbers and Jonathan Butler, affected general textbook descriptions of the Millerites, which became more accurate and nuanced. The survey textbooks, and I've watched this as I teach American history year after year and look at the textbooks. The survey textbooks have yet to discover Ellen White and the Adventists, despite their own robust connection to a larger American historical narrative. As noted by Bullen Lockhart in 1989 and by Douglas Morgan in 2001. Because Adventists have grown into a world church of significant size, outnumbering Mormons and Jews, the prominence of their female co-founder, who outlived Joseph Bates and James White by several decades, was a historical story waiting to happen by 2009. Now, to tell the next part of the story, I need to describe to you how I became involved with Ellen White in my profession of teaching and writing about and studying American history. As a college student and then a young professional in the 1970s, I kept at arm's length the discussions of Ellen White that were then roiling Adventism that many of you remember so well. Those contentious discussions are well known. Not as well known as the extent of anguish and personal pain that affected most of the people involved. I picked up just enough about that at the time to know that studying Ellen White professionally was not for me. When I entered the historical profession in the mid-1980s, my older and wiser colleagues made it clear that enmeshing oneself in Adventist history in general and in Ellen White history in particular was a recipe for professional suicide. That was a good reason to keep my distance. And I was plenty busy anyway, studying American religion and culture, particularly in the Civil War era. I started to change my mind in 1996. That year I attended a centennial conference on the occasion of the 100th anniversary of the death of Harriet Beecher Stowe. The conference was held in Hartford, Connecticut, where she had lived in the later years of her life. And at the conference, we heard a great deal about various female authors of the 19th century, including some who had been recently rediscovered, such as Harriet Jacobs and Frances Harper. I remember thinking to myself, I bet not one of these scholars has ever thought of Ellen White, and she is a prominent 19th century American woman writer. And if left to themselves, it was unlikely these scholars would ever discover her, or at least not for a very long time. And about that time, Adventist historians who had met together in the 70s and early 80s during stormy times and had then let their meetings lapse began meeting again, I believe at the encouragement of Gary Land and Brian Strayer, among others. The Association of Seventh-day Adventist Historians, or ASDA, met at the Walla Walla College Portland campus in 1998, and I remember saying in casual conversation, it was time for Adventist scholars to introduce Ellen White to the general academic community. We all nodded in agreement and did nothing. In 2001, we met here at Andrews, along with guest speaker Ronald Numbers. I talked about the idea some more, and I asked Numbers if he would be willing to chair a national conference in Portland, Maine. He said, sure, and again, I did nothing. In 2004, we met at Pacific Union College along with the invited guest, Jonathan Butler. I asked him if he would be interested in participating in a national conference on Ellen White. He said, sure, and again, I did nothing. Then in 2007, we met at Oakwood, and during a tour of their extensive campus, our bus broke down. I sat in the back row with Julius Naum, Michael Campbell, and Douglas Morgan, and we were brainstorming about how this much-discussed but still imaginary Ellen White conference would actually look like. It took a long time to get the bus going, probably just as well that day. So we actually got around to the concrete stage of planning a conference, in the eventual book that would emerge from the conference, a book that would introduce historical scholars to Ellen White. Within a few weeks, we enlisted Gary Land from Andrews and Ronald Numbers from the University of Wisconsin, and the conference began taking shape. We wanted to introduce the general academic community, especially religious historians, to Ellen White because we knew that they knew very little, if anything, about her. If they knew about her directly, it was likely from reading Numbers' 1976 book, Prophetess of Health, and portions of Boland Lockhart's Seeking a Sanctuary, or again, those encyclopedia entries about the shut door. And they also might know something about John Harvey Kellogg. We agreed we ought to bring together, as chapter authors, historical scholars who had already done work on Ellen White. Most of them were Adventists who participated in the ASDA discussions, and we've been talking about this by now for a long time. Some were former Adventists, and we identified two non-SDA scholars who had done significant research on Ellen White, Ann Taves and Laura Vance. The Adventists and former Adventist scholars tended to be somewhat older or somewhat younger than I, as my generation had almost entirely avoided poking into Adventist history because it was such a minefield when we were in graduate school. Because our conference would enlist respondents who knew little or perhaps nothing about Ellen White, and we wanted to have respondents from the larger community as well as respondents who knew Ellen White, we resolved to encourage them to attend and to fully participate by covering all of the costs of their transportation, food, and housing. We knew the price tag for the conference would be about $100,000, a reality that we found terrifying. But believing that introducing such a significant figure to the general academic world was a landmark moment, we decided to apply to the National Endowment for the Humanities for half of our funding. They have a conference grant for path-breaking work to be presented in a conference. In our grant narrative, we had to introduce Ellen White to the scholars who would be serving as referees for our proposal. We also needed to show that the conference and the project was credible enough to invite the interest of a major academic publisher. Have you ever done call portering? This was kind of like call portering. I'd actually studiously avoided doing call portering, and now I ended up being the one to write the proposal. I guess it was my punishment for my earlier lack of call portering. But anyway, by the time our proposal went to the National Endowment for the Humanities in December 2008, which was not good timing because the crash had just happened, and I was kind of hoping that we were just under the wire and people hadn't gotten a chance to write their proposals after the crash started, but I was wrong. Anyway, we had a letter of intent, though, at that time from Oxford University Press. That means that the press thinks the project sounds worthwhile, but they expect to see and approve firsthand a manuscript before they commit to actually publishing it. That's an occasion for more call portering. How should we talk about Ellen White to an audience that is largely unaware of her? I'm going to share with you a few paragraphs of the grant narrative and invite you to consider how this might sound to you if you were hearing about Ellen White for the first time. Here we go. She was one of the first American women to speak in public. Crowds of 20,000 and more flocked to hear her outdoor temperance lectures. She is one of the most prolific woman authors in history. Her 40-plus books translated into more than 100 languages sold millions of copies. Equipped with only a few years of elementary education, she founded 5 colleges and universities and aided in the survival of several others. Her writings produced the largest Protestant parochial educational system in the world. Her interest in health spawned the breakfast food industry and inspired the creation of thousands of clinics and hospitals. When she died in 1915, the New York Times and other newspapers across the country reported the event and discussed her achievements. Yet today, Ellen Gould Harmon White, 1827 to 1915, is a little-known footnote in American religious history. A follower of William Miller and eventual co-founder of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, she was enshrined by her denomination as a visionary prophet and virtually forgotten by nearly everyone else. Peter W. Williams expressed the opinion of a number of American religious historians when, in the 1999 volume Perspectives on American Religion and Culture, ranked her with Anne Hutchinson, Harriet Beecher Stowe, Mary Baker Eddy, and Amy Semple McPherson as one of the most prominent women in American religious history. However, the full range of her life and work and her relationship to American religious history and women's history remain unexplored. Ellen Harmon and her family were caught up in the Millerite excitement that swept through New England in the early 1840s. William Miller, a self-taught Bible student and lay preacher, declared that a time-related prophecy in Daniel 8, because you have to give them all that part too, you know, for them to have the context, describing the cleansing of the sanctuary actually referred to a specific time when the second coming of Christ would occur. When the predicted date came and went in 1844, many of Miller's adherents fell away disillusioned. Others sought to redefine the events of their great disappointment and forge new movements. Miller's most direct spiritual heirs formed the Advent Christian faith. Ellen Harmon and a handful of others, Joseph Bates, James White, whom she later married, and Uriah Smith, emphasized observance of the seventh-day Sabbath and belief in an imminent, though undated, second coming. In 1863, they formed the Seventh-day Adventist denomination. Ellen Harmon, a physically frail, spiritually sensitive girl who turned 17 just after the Great Disappointment, began to experience visions and dreams that led her to function as, in her words, a messenger of the Lord. Believing her messages were inspired by God, her co-religionists regarded her as a prophet. Her public visions led to publications, sermons, and administrative advice that eventually made her the primary architect of her denomination. Although she never held a formal church office, Ellen White played a uniquely influential role. Her husband James, a powerful Advent preacher and prolific writer, editor, and publisher, shared her pulpit, or desk as they called it, with his wife at hundreds of camp meetings across the U.S. He aided her in preparing her vision-inspired testimonies for publication, and the couple inhabited the pages of Adventist periodicals for decades. After James White's death in 1881, her writing and speaking career continued to expand. During her lifetime, she and her co-founders created a tightly organized international denomination with 130,000 members, 56% of them in the United States. The difference between that group and the denomination today, including its size, which in that year, 2008, was 15 million, major institutions, worldwide scope, Adventists function in 203 of 237 countries, distinctive beliefs, is largely the result of Ellen White's influence. The White family founded all three North American Adventist publishing houses and marketed their books door to door throughout the United States and later around the world. Ellen White developed an interest in health and medicine and encouraged the establishment of hospitals. She identified the location of several and secured the property for some with down payments from her own pocket. Perhaps a childhood accident that forced her to drop out of school encouraged her lifelong interest in education. She established even more colleges than hospitals, and she donated the proceeds from some of her books to support Adventist education. She spent nearly 2 years in Europe and lived in Australia for 9 more, returning home with ideas for increasing the global growth of the church. Her suggestions for church organization were adopted, and near the end of her life, she saw one of her proteges installed as the longest-serving president of the denomination. As her own religious faith developed from an early emphasis on God's law, a preoccupation for Sabbatarian Adventists who insisted on worshiping on Saturday instead of Sunday, to salvation by faith in God, she brought most of the denomination along with her. Her role within the church as an influential female leader makes her a person of interest in the study of American religion. There is more to the story, however. For example, she is a significant figure in comparative religion, but her role has not been fully examined. The Seventh-day Adventist Church is one of the four most innovative denominations founded in the United States in the 19th century, along with the Church of Jesus Christ Latter-day Saints, the Church of Christ Scientists, and the Jehovah's Witnesses. The LDS Church and its leaders undergo thorough historical treatment, and Christian Science has been extensively examined as well. Much less attention has been accorded the witnesses and the Adventists. To date, there has not been a systematic examination of the full range and scope of Ellen White's place in American history. This proposal seeks to describe how a comprehensive book on Ellen White will be constructed. We seek to weave together isolated strands of existing Ellen White scholarship into book chapters enriched by additional contextual work. Conference organizers propose to link up scholars who are knowledgeable about Ellen White with specialists in her historical context. Such conversations have never taken place, which helps to explain why Ellen White has remained almost entirely within an enclosed sectarian universe. A carefully developed, intensely focused, and intentionally structured conference and book will produce more analysis and synthesis in a matter of months than has generally accreted for several decades. Chapter authors are selected on the basis of their previous scholarly work on Ellen White. Respondents are chosen for their ability to subject chapters to additional angles of scrutiny, whether biographical or contextual. Both the formal responses to each chapter and the less formal discussions by all the participants are crucial to a thorough study. We intend the conference and book project to model constructive discussion of a complex but important topic with sensitivity, fairness, and historical rigor. Well, we were pretty pleased with our proposal to the National Endowment for the Humanities, and so were they for the most part. I think the panel of five referees would have accepted our proposal, except for the fact that one referee thought that in spite of all our attempts at balancing respondents and having each conference participant apply a rubric to each chapter to prevent bias, the project would be too sectarian. That was part of the quandary we faced throughout our planning. Funding sources outside the denomination thought we were too sectarian, too likely to be driven by public relations motives, and they were sure that the general denomination was behind all of this, while philanthropists within the denomination tended to suspect that our project would be too iconoclastic. So when our NEH grant proposal was rejected in June 2009, and they only accepted 10% of their proposals that year, which was sad for us, we had less than 4 months to raise the second half of our $100,000 budget. The project owes a debt of gratitude to the many individuals and organizations mentioned in the book's acknowledgments. We wanted the 2009 gathering in Portland, Maine to be a working conference where we discuss previously circulated chapter drafts and chapter responses. So we needed to limit the event to direct participants. We could be talking in detail about this. So we would have 20 or so chapter authors and two respondents for each chapter, one who is Adventist and one who is not. We also added plenary speakers who are nationally known scholars and biographers. Joan Hedrick, who wrote the Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of Harriet Beecher Stowe in 1995, and Grant Wacker, a religious historian at Duke, who's completing a biography of Billy Graham. And as we put this conference together, it was kind of like setting up a blind date. You know how nervous that, it makes you more nervous than the people going on the date, probably. I wondered what scholars who had not been nurtured in the Adventist world, nearly half of the 67 participants, would think of her. Some of the chapter respondents had never heard of Ellen White and had been recruited for their knowledge of her larger context, and that would include Joan Hedrick. Some were aware of her connection with the Millerites, who are known to academia almost exclusively because of the disappointed, and a good number because they were familiar with Prophetess of Health, and which is now in its third edition. What would they think of her when they encountered the wider range of topics in our book? What for respondents would constitute valid studies of Ellen White? Some clues emerged as the conference proceeded. It was interesting to watch the respondents decode Adventist patois, because there were lots of Adventists there. It's hard to avoid lapsing into insider language, even when trying not to. The respondents were appropriately unsparing when it happened. Participants were fascinated by Graham Sherrick's recontextualizing of the testimonies. They quickly grasped the significance of Ellen White's role in building healthy congregations as Sherrick reconstructed her original structure of social webs and relationships, relationship networks that underlie the testimonies. He reconstructed the whole community environment. I wonder how their responses might have differed if Sherrick's chapter had begun with the published testimonies and moved forward to show their subsequent influence as Adventist treatments have conventionally done. That, of course, is part of the story, but historians like to begin at the beginning. Conference participants asked rigorous questions. They wanted to know every facet of Ellen White's involvement in racial issues. They strove to understand the context of the great controversy narrative as it unfolded through various chapters. They sought to unravel Adventist and former Adventist relationship to Ellen White. And I wish I had been a fly on the wall to hear Joe Willey explain in detail to Grant Wacker the sanctuary doctrine. I missed that one. They vigorously discussed her authorial practices, including plagiarism, but without the angst of Adventist internal conversations. They were very interested in the visions, both the way they unfolded as events and the way they were received. They concluded that investigating her story was an important task, and the details were complex enough and juicy enough to invite further research. So I'll show you two pictures from our conference that took place. The date was coincidental that we would actually start on October 22. We didn't really intend to make that happen. It just sort of happened. You have to get the lower rates for the hotels after the peak of the color season, which is kind of early in northern New England. So there we were. This is what the area around Portland looks like. So still touches the 19th century, even though in the mid-century a lot of the town burned. So a lot of what she lived amongst was burned. And then the first talk we had was the opening night, October 22, Thursday night. And we had invited Joan Hedrick to give that talk to explain how she went about the task of writing about a 19th century woman writer, Harriet Beecher Stowe. And of course, she was a little nervous starting her talk on October 22, but she was a good sport about that. She said, "I'm very excited about this occasion because I think this conference is bringing into visibility a woman who was a very important spiritual and institutional force that many people didn't know about and I didn't know about. I really applaud this effort to bring Ellen White back into visibility." And at the end of her talk, there were a number of questions. They all came from the Adventists in the audience. And if you were Adventist and heard the questions, you would know some of the complexities of the question. If you weren't, you probably didn't. But the first question was from Ciro Sepulveda from Oakwood. He said, "It's clear from hearing your talk about Harriet Beecher Stowe that you have profound admiration for your subject, but how do you deal with the flaws?" And she said, "I view them as great complications of the plot, as good material for biographers." And they really do. The flaws, that's what brings a person into sharp focus. Nobody is human without having flaws. To see the flaws as well as the virtues and how they intersect, we can all see in ourselves that our strengths also have a downside. Seeing the human being is seeing the human being whole. I don't see it as a problem, but as a possibility. I see it as great literary material and sometimes as great didactic material." And then we got to the business of talking about all the chapters. Most of them were spread over two long days of about 10 hours each. We had 45 minutes per chapter. most of the time was spent by respondents' remarks and questions from the audience. The author would just make a short comment at the beginning because the people had already seen and read the chapter drafts. And here you see Joe Conforti from the University of Southern Maine responding to Ron Graybill's chapter. Ron is sitting in front of Joe there. You can see Gary Land, who was moderating that part of it. He's just to the left of Ron Graybill. And then the one person who wasn't able to be there was Ann Taves, who had written a book called Fits, Trances, and Visions, Experiencing Religions and Religious Experience from Wesley to James. And she had included in that book a chapter on Millerites and the Adventists and talked about James and Ellen White. She was president of the American Academy of Religion that year and wasn't able to come to Portland, so we had her there via Skype. Here Julius Nam is moderating, and we actually had a very lively discussion with her and with the respondents and other people asking questions. It was a good part of the discussion. Here's Graham Sherrick talking about his chapter on the testimonies, which was published, most of it, in Spectrum this spring. And then, you know, one thing I wondered about was, okay, when we have all these meals together and we kind of had a captive audience, we provided all of the meals because we wanted people not to be running off into long cocktail hours and stuff, you know, instead of going to our little sessions. So we really worked them hard. And I thought, well, maybe all the Adventists will sit at tables and the others will sit at other tables, but that really didn't turn out to be the case at all. And I would love to have been a fly on the wall for this lower picture that you see from left to right. We have Ron Graybill, Don McAdams, Joan Hedrick, Vern Carner, Ron Lawson, and Bill Peterson. And it looks like they're having a good time. Grant Wacker is sitting in the center here. He's from Duke University, ended up writing the foreword to the book. And the left side of the picture is Heather Curtis, who teaches at Tufts and was one of the respondents to, I think, Rennie Shefflin's chapter. And here you just kind of a random slice of participants who were there. Grant Wacker, Ron Lawson, Amanda Porterfield, who was at that time editor of the journal. I'm blanking out. Woody can help me. No. Anyway, it's church history. Thank you, Brain. Editor of the journal Church History. And then Joan Francis from Washington Adventist University and Ginger Hanks Harwood from La Sierra. That Friday evening, we met at the Thursday evening lecture was at the University of Southern Maine, so we could have a connection with the academic scene locally. Friday night, we were in a local, it had been a congregational church, had become a Unitarian church, but it was a church that was present when Ellen White was a girl there in Portland. Grant Wacker talked about Billy Graham and the challenges of cultural biography. He mentioned, this conference ranks at the top of what I've learned already in reading these papers. It's been enormously instructive. And then he talked about Billy Graham. He talked about some of the flaws of his character. Billy Graham, while he had a lot of influence advising American presidents, advised Richard Nixon during the Vietnam War to bomb the dams and dikes of the Mekong River and flood North Vietnam that would have killed at least hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people. Nixon chose not to do this, and when this became public, that's one of the things that comes up when you listen to the tapes. It's Billy Graham advising Nixon to do this. Billy Graham later in life repented of this advice he had given and talks movingly about that and what you do when you made a mistake and so forth. But then towards the conclusion of his remarks, Grant Wacker said, according to Martin Marty, all good history or read biography enables us to live the present in light of the past. It turns the evaluation question around. The task is not so much for us as biographers to evaluate them, but to stand back and with humility allow their lives to evaluate us. On Sabbath morning of the time we were there, we had an early morning church service also at that same church, and we had invited Kendra Holowiak to speak. Her Bidwell ancestors in New England go back to the original days of Adventism. And so that was very interesting to hear her perspective. And she talked about disappointment. And she talked about the sorrow psalms in her talk entitled Joy in the Morning. We also included Ellen White's favorite hymns. I thought it was very moving to sit in that old church listening to Alden Thompson play the piano and hear John Pauline lead us in singing these hymns. And I'll just share with you a few things that Kendra said. I'm drawn to theology that takes seriously the experience of weeping at night and doesn't let an absent God off the hook. But in the anger and agony of experiences of disorientation, keeps talking with God, even if it's to raise a fist and voice in protest. Somehow in that action of refusing to give up on a God who seems to have given up on us, somehow there is a new experience of the presence of God, a rushing in, of new wonder and gift and gratitude. Weeping may linger for, oh, sorry. I'm reading my notes instead of what I'm supposed to be reading. Is sorry. Weeping may linger for the night, but joy comes in the morning. How does one move from the poetry of night to the joy of the morning? How does one move from my God, why hast thou forsaken me, to praise God from whom all blessings flow? And the tears in the eyes of people there that morning were not just from the people who were Adventists. At their best, communities of faith do what the Psalms do. They take the seasons of life and bring them to speech. Seasons of orientation and disorientation and new orientation. Communities of faith know great disappointments, and they weep until the day dawns. But then there's a brand new day, and those same communities of faith sing their Advent hymns once again. Well, we went on to have more discussion that day. One chapter that was discussed was Ted Lefteroff's chapter on early Adventism. Here, the respondents are Alden Thompson and Ruth Alden Doan, who's a well-known historian of Methodist history from Hollins University. Ted was not able to complete his chapter at that time because he was a very busy pastor trying to finish a dissertation. He's since moved to the Loma Linda Ellen White Estate office. So because he was not able to do that, we enlisted Bert Holowiak to write about early Adventism. And we had to do some of that as we finished the chapters and got them ready. Here is Peggy Bendroth, who is the congregational librarian in Boston. Behind her with the white hair is David Rowe, who's a biographer of William Miller. Floyd Greenleaf wrote about Adventist education. His respondents were W.G. Nelson from Kettering and William Trollinger from the University of Dayton. So, and then you see just kind of a slice of the people involved. Here we passed microphones around. I keep bumping into things, sorry. And Alden Thompson there thinking. I think that's what he's doing in that picture. Beverly Beam, Susan Gardner, Joe Willey. And on the left in side next to Joe Willey's computer is Daryl Ward from Kettering. So we just had a whole collection of people. Don McAdams was very involved and during that time. And I think this inspired Don McAdams, Brian, to make an offer of, he set up a fund to fund research in early Adventist history for Adventist historians. It's going to really be not just about Ellen White, but about all kinds of facets of Adventist history. It will be a really welcome gift and will lead to more research, I know. Ronald Lawson is working on a multi-volume sociology of Adventism. And Laura Vance, who teaches at Warren Wilson College, wrote a book, Adventism in Crisis, is about Adventism and gender. And she wrote a chapter for this book on Ellen White and gender. One of her respondents was Bernadette McCauley, who teaches at Hunter College in New York. And you can see Merlin Burt here, Graham Sherrock, and others who were involved. And at the end, I was really glad people could still smile when it was all over, because we worked them so hard. But it's interesting. People stuck around. In fact, Joan Hedrick had a family member who was quite ill and needed to get home and was going to leave early, and she stayed the whole time. She thought it was pretty interesting. And virtually everybody did stick around for the whole thing. And we were kind of a real loyal band by the time it was all over, having spent so much time together. It was just fascinating. And people who were involved, in fact, we left Portland in a glow of enthusiasm and goodwill. Several of the non-SDA participants told me that the conference was so interesting and so stimulating that they had trouble focusing on their own work upon returning home. Well, Gary Land and Ronald Numbers and I knew that our work as editors had just begun. And let me stop here for a moment to talk about the significance of the work of both Gary Land and Ronald Numbers. Gary Land gave his whole professional life to Andrews University. When he came to Andrews, I don't think he had any idea that as an American intellectual historian, he would end up writing so much about Adventist history. But with all the materials here and this and all of the reasons to look at things Adventist, he did exactly that. And I believe that his contributions to Adventist history are incalculable over the years. And his own work, his research, his writing, his editing, his encouragement of other historians, his encouragement of the Association of SDA Historians, his modeling of what a historian does, rigorous investigation, but fair-minded and honest. That's just what we would want historians to be like, is what Gary Land was. And we lost him much too soon. So that was a really a sad part of our process. We were grateful that he was able to see the book come out. He was able to sign a book for Brian a few days before he died this last spring. And in fact, when the book came out, Grant Wacker in the foreword says, "Taken together, these chapters show how White was both a product and a producer for age. They also show that however one judges the role of supernatural inspiration, White ranked as one of the most gifted and influential religious leaders in American history, male or female." And that, for many American historians, was news. Now, a couple more things I want to tell you about what happened after the conference. We had given general guidelines to the authors before they began their work, but now we had to incorporate reams of suggestions from respondents and other conference participants and to mesh the chapters together so they complemented each other. That took a lot of time, painstaking revision and editing. One of our initial goals was to include younger scholars in our array of chapter authors, and our hopes did not materialize. Our younger scholars were caught up in the demands of dissertations, growing families, and a host of other concerns, and one by one they had to bow out of the project. We were grateful we were able to draw in additional authors such as Bert Holowiak and Fritz Guy, who significantly contributed to the finished product. After 2 years of hauling and tugging at the manuscript, we sent it off to Oxford with high hopes. While we got some good positive feedback from referees, we also got the message that our manuscript was too long. We felt that every detail and every angle we had included was crucial, but we also wanted to remain aware of how much volume our audience could handle. So before anyone could ask us to cut it or just dump us outright, we offered to cut the manuscript by a third of its length. Now, if you've ever had to do that to yourself or to other people's writing, you know that that is pure torture. Oxford was so eager for us to do it that it almost hurt our feelings. But we set to work. This was actually, this was right after Gary Land got out of the hospital, and so we didn't draw him into this, but Ron Numbers and I sat down for 4 days and did what we did. And then, of course, we had to have months of haggling with individual authors to make sure we got everything right, but still keeping it to the right length. We cut overlaps, extensive footnotes, lengthy quotations. We also consolidated 4 related chapters into 2 co-authored chapters. And finally, in the fall of 2012, we sent in the manuscript and we waited nervously for a very long time. The first respondent they gave it to was almost finished, sounded very enthusiastic, and then ended up in the hospital with some kind of serious or perhaps fatal illness, and they had to start over again with a new referee. Finally, April 2013, we heard from Oxford that they intended to publish our manuscript. There were many more editing tasks that remained, but we rejoiced this past April when we got the first copies of the book, and we were so glad that Gary Land was able, after battling cancer for several years, to sign and hand out copies before he died April 26, 2014. Now we expectantly await the outcome of another first date, the larger audience, primarily non-Adventists, that will read our book. How will they see Ellen White's role in American religious history? Will they be intrigued enough to want to do research themselves? If so, what questions will they ask? Responses to the book are just beginning to appear. It usually takes about 2 years for the book reviews to get written and published in a variety of academic journals. Oxford University Press sent out early review copies of our manuscript, and those resulted in the reviews that have appeared in Ministry, Spectrum, the Biblical Research Institute newsletter, the Adventist Review, and Christianity Today's literary magazine, Books and Culture. Oxford also sought reactions from academics, one of which is included on the back cover of Ellen Harmon White, American Prophet. What we see there, we would expect to be good news. That's why they put it there. But what I particularly appreciate about Professor Lee Eric Schmidt's comment is his remark that as a collaborative venture, it is superbly orchestrated. It demonstrates White's profound relevance to any number of historiographies. Dialogue and conversation are what we've sought in the production of this book. We know more than to expect unanimity, but a constructive civil conversation is a good starting point, we think. The spring 2014 issue of Spectrum published a review of American Prophet by David Holland, assistant professor of North American religious history at Harvard Divinity School. Holland notes the puzzling lack of knowledge of Ellen White in the academic community. Holland is not sure why White is so little studied and understood, but he makes some educated guesses. He concludes that Ellen White would not be surprised at the neglect, as she would deem her message was too otherworldly for other secular historians. Here I have to differ with Holland, because Ellen White was very aware of the tension she got from the secular world and welcomed contact with journalists and others who sought her out to satisfy their curiosity. Holland's speculations make me wonder what you think. Why do you think few non-Adventists have heard of Ellen White? How do Adventists talk to each other about Ellen White? How do they talk to the larger world about her? What should characterize the conversation? We'll have time to talk about that in a moment. A few weeks ago, Lavon Neff's review of American Prophet appeared in Books and Culture. Neff described her own connections with Adventism. Her husband, David, was one of the pastors of the Walla Walla College Church when I joined the faculty there. And why Ellen White was part of the reason she and her family left. Given that past, said Neff, I picked American Prophet up with reluctance. I'm glad I got past my initial hesitation. It turned out to be an engrossing study of an era, a church, and an indomitable woman I didn't know nearly as well as I thought I did. After reviewing the content of the book in a nuanced way, only feasible for someone who has significant prior knowledge of Ellen White, Neff concluded, whatever else she may have been, Ellen Harmon White was an able leader of men who deserves to be more widely known. This book is a welcome step in that direction. In record time, our work at the conference found its way into an academic book, Robert C. Fuller's The Body of Faith, A Biological History of Religion in America, published by the University of Chicago Press in 2013. Fuller was a respondent to Ann Tave's chapter at the Portland Conference, and his book manuscript was already well underway. But after the conference, he incorporated a discussion of Ellen White, albeit based on secondary sources, in one of his chapters. I fully expect we will learn a lot from scholars outside the Adventist fold as they turn more scrutiny on the life and times of Ellen White. Their perspective will raise new questions, new angles of inquiry, and the possibility that someone out there might actually be paying attention to what Adventists say to each other about their collective history ought to raise the quality of our internal discourse. We have a lot to look forward to. Thank you.
Okay, we have a few minutes for a few questions. David? Joe?
Thank you very much. First, a response to your question about why there hasn't been much attention paid to her. I think it's because the Adventists built a wall around her. We have struggled immensely to protect her. You talked about the response from scholars that's coming in. I'm curious about the response from the official church. What kind of vibrations are you hearing? Is it friendly? Are they paying attention?
I think what I hope the official church will do is to be basically neutral. That's because what the book is doing is not seeking to, well, one of the rules we had at the conference and afterward was no hagiography and no bashing, okay? That we would encourage historians to study the issue the way historians do, looking into all of the evidence, being critical in terms of how they handle evidence, but not coming at it with some sort of agenda one way or the other. Now, people who read the chapters carefully see nuances that most people won't see about whatever background a historian might have had, but what we seek to do is to bring together a whole host of angles of looking at Ellen White. And what I have found and what I thought from the beginning was that Ellen White can handle scrutiny. That's not a problem. And I do think that it is, because she's so special and so revered as a church, we've been hesitant to just let the multitudes paw at her, you know. But handled respectfully, and all I saw at this conference was utmost respect for her. I think that it can actually be a very positive thing. So I think there's less to fear about her being investigated maybe than some people have had.
I just want to congratulate you on the way you have created a non-fictional narrative that is designed to persuade the reader favorably toward Ellen White and toward the history that she participates in. I've been working on a project about religion as an art form with the same kind of intention. And this summer, in all places, in the National Arctic Wildlife Refuge, I ran into a lawyer who writes appellate briefs for the courts. And as we got to talking, he was basically doing the same thing that I thought that religion does. That's not to overlook the fallacies, the contradictions, and so forth, but it's to create a non-fictional narrative that will persuade the audience, be it a judge or the larger population, that this presentation has been done artistically and that it does present something truthful without raising the question of incidents, ideas that would destroy the narrative, even though they're true, or ruin the narrative because you have included false elements that falsify the narrative. And I could see that as when I was listening to what you were saying, and I haven't finished the book yet, Gary gave me a copy, but I haven't finished it yet, that basically that is what I think Adventist historians have to do. They have to consciously create a non-fictional narrative that will persuade their readers that this guy ought to be acquitted, maybe, you see, or this woman ought to be acquitted, but nevertheless does not intervene in ways that destroy the intentionality of the artist who is the author.
Well, I would have to say that I think if there was an agenda amongst the historians who worked on the project, it was to present the case that Ellen White was worthy of investigation in terms of creating a narrative that would present her in an unfailingly positive light. If we had tried to do that, Ron Numbers would not have been a co-editor in Oxford, would not have published the book. So,
Terry, thank you for your work on this book. It's been very much appreciated. My question comes to you from experience. You talked a little earlier about flaws in a woman, and with the speaker you had at the conference on Harriet Beecher Stowe. Now, you're working on a biography of Ellen White, and I'd like to know how you handled the flaws. The editing of the encyclopedia that I did with Jerry Moon brought out the fact that, yeah, there are a lot of little details here and there, And how you handle those flaws is, I found it to be quite difficult working on the encyclopedia. We readily admit she's a woman like all of us, so therefore she's human and will have her flaws. But when you put your finger on one of them or many of them and you want to dissect them or talk about them, then we become very protective, very apologetic, very defensive. So how are you handling the woman?
Well, I'm still dealing with her adolescent years, so I'm, so most of those things are kind of in the future for me. I know that it won't be easy. I feel that, however, that I don't want to cover up things or to make facts look different than what actually happened, to try to construct things in a way other than what actually happened, but to try to, and this is what I think is so valuable about what Joan Hedrick said, to see the human being whole. And I think if you look at Ellen White whole, which is really hard to do with 70 to 100,000 pages of manuscript, depending on how you count, such a complex life, and 70 years of a public career, I don't even think that should be allowed because biographers then have to try to deal with it. I started my career with John Keats, and his main career was 18 months long. I don't know what happened to me that I ended up here. But to try to see the human being whole, that's really the job of the biographer, and to not skim over or bury flaws, to include the whole picture, but to then see the person whole. That's the best I can say in my rather, early part of my task that I'm in now. Something's happening here. Now, I have a question for you. Okay? Something to think about, something I'd like to hear from you, and maybe you can think about it for a while. You probably know about the Shaker Chair. This is a beautiful artifact created by people in a colony with some interesting beliefs, but their beliefs, somehow they managed to translate into an aesthetic that's widely respected even today. And it was especially interesting to the Trappist monk Thomas Merton, who said of the Shaker Chair, "The peculiar grace of a Shaker Chair is due to the fact that it was made by someone capable of believing that an angel might come and sit on it." And I was thinking, okay, Seventh-day Adventists, the thing that holds the Adventist denomination together is a belief that Jesus is coming soon. Is there or could there be some kind of object or cultural product, creative response that would sum up for Adventism what the Shaker Chair does for the Shaker belief that at any moment an angel could come and sit on that chair? So that's something I'd like you to leave you with, is that what would that cultural response be? And if you have any further questions, happy to hear those.
It's kind of a bittersweet moment for us at Forum. We had planned originally that our colleague Gary Land would make this presentation. That was our plan, but as everybody knows, that didn't work. And we are still sorrowing as a result of that. But we thank Professor Amott, who has come and done a very admirable job in Gary's place. So let's thank her very much.